That brings us to the first lecture of this session here, as we deal with what in many ways launched the modern revolutionary age, the French Revolution. We all need to understand the French Revolution. It was an evil thing. It caused a lot of death and destruction. But unfortunately, the philosophy that led to the French Revolution influences so many of the revolutions and what goes on in the world today. And if we don't understand it, we are weakened. We stand for reformation. We stand for revival. We are going for the Great Commission. But what's important is if we understand the French Revolution, then we will be able to counter it with biblical reformation teaching. The French Revolution was one of the most influential events of modern history. And yes, you do have this chapter in the manual, so you can follow along in the, if you want to make notes in the margin. France went from being a monarchy to a republic between 1789 and 1799. It went to a reign of terror, a dictatorship. It was one of the most tumultuous times in European history. Much myth and much romantic legend has been written on what some politicians would like the French Revolution to have been. But the reality is the French Revolution was a monstrous horror. It would have been something none of us would have enjoyed living through, if we would have survived at all. In the name of liberty, equality, fraternity, or death, over 40,000 people lost their heads to the guillotine. This big blade dropped by force of gravity on the heads of people who were considered the enemies of the revolution. 300,000 more people were publicly executed by firing squads or drownings or other methods of mass murder. Ultimately, many millions died in 25 years of war and upheavals that resulted from the French Revolution. The French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars killed millions and turned Europe upside down. The French Revolution has been the inspiration and the model for all socialist and communist revolutions in modern history. This is their gold standard. This is their root, their source. Lord Acton, in his lectures on the French Revolution, observed, "The appalling thing in the French Revolution is not the tumult, but the design. Through all the fire and the smoke, we perceive the evidence of calculating organization." French Revolution wasn't spontaneous at all. You see, actually, the hands of real manipulative behind the scenes, pulling the strings, puppeteering. The managers, Lord Acton said, remain studiously concealed and masked. But there is no doubt about their presence from the first. The tools of the French Revolution were disinformation, propaganda, subversion of language, malice, envy, hatred, and jealousy. Now, you must understand there's a difference between misinformation and disinformation. Misinformation is a misunderstanding. A person might honestly have meant this and thought it to be true, but give you the false information. It could come from a spelling error, a punctuation error, proofreading error, errors entered, and that is what you call misinformation. Misinformation is errors or mistakes. You get the wrong date, you get the wrong country, the wrong place, whatever, but it was not deliberate, but it's still not accurate. Disinformation is deliberately deceiving people. Governments often engage in disinformation, especially in times of war. They disinform the enemy, but more often these days, governments are disinforming their own people. They're giving them false information to deceive the people in order to stay in power or to get away with crimes or corruption or whatever. So the French Revolution was fueled by disinformation and propaganda and the subversion of language, changing the meaning of words, malice, envy, hatred, jealousy, mass murder, foreign military adventurism as a diversion to distract the masses from the failure of government. As the French Revolution failed to produce anything it had promised to the masses, it had to keep distracting them by more and more wars with the neighboring countries to keep the people distracted from the fact that the government was a total failure at home and hadn't achieved anything they'd ever promised. And so they kept having more adventures until they'd invaded everywhere in Europe as far afield as Russia. These tools have been implemented by more modern revolutionaries. Vladimir Lenin, Trotsky and Joseph Stalin in Russia, Mao Zedong in China, Fidel Castro in Cuba, Che Guevara of Cuba, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. All of these are examples of people who continue the policies of the French Revolution today. The power mad and disenchanted have continued to sing the praises of the French Revolution and to attempt to replicate its ideals in revolutions as far afield as Russia, China, Cuba, North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Angola, the Congo, and Zimbabwe. Demonic forces and the Enlightenment ideas of humanist philosophers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire prepared the ground for revolution. Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire were like the Karl Marx of modern times. What Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire wrote, Robespierre implemented. Like what Marx wrote is what Lenin and Stalin implemented. So the philosophers Rousseau and Voltaire inspired the actions of the French revolutions. Historian Otto Scott observed French intellectuals, middle class and upper classes, had grown ashamed of their country, ashamed of their history, ashamed of their institutions. Such a phenomenon had never before arisen in any nation or race throughout the long history of mankind. Nobody before had ever become so disenchanted with their country as the French people came with their own country. And this was actually, a lot of it was through disinformation, and it was through the media seeking to agitate the people to the point where they're all ready to run to the streets and kill people. A great loosening began. Families were broken down. Communities were undermined. The country slowly came apart. For the first time since the decadent days of Rome, pornography openly emerged from the caves and circulated openly in the civilized nation. The Catholic Church in France was intellectually gutted. They didn't think it was necessary to be intelligent, and they made it to be spiritual, to be uninformed and uneducated. The priests lost their faith along with their congregations. You can see when the morals are corrupted and the church is corrupted, the society starts to decay. Strange cults appeared. Sex rituals, black magic, Satanism, occult, perversion did not only become acceptable, but became fashionable. It became fashionable to be a homosexual in the times leading up to the French Revolution. Homosexuals held public balls to which heterosexuals were invited, and the police guarded their carriages. Perversion became acceptable and fashionable. The air grew thick with plans to restructure and reconstruct all traditional French society and all French institutions. The heirs of the Enlightenment of the late 18th century, the 1700s, launched the first revolution in history against the ideas of Christianity and, most important, of Christianity's God. The French Revolution was an anti-Christian revolution first and foremost at its heart. The press was spearhead, font and fuel for the revolution. The media, the newspapers, the journals were mixed with politics and smut. The journals were the magazines of that time. They admired agitators extravagantly, and they never discussed the church without the mention of scandal. They never mentioned the government without criticism. They relied heavily on tales of sin and scandal in high places and high-handed outrages of the court. No name, however highly placed and illustrious, escaped the scandal-mongering gutter press. Through its journals and its pamphlets, it could distort and color and plead and argue and lie and report and misreport the information upon which the balance of the realm depended. And the media here was seen to be a very dangerous revolutionary force, because it started to undermine the social fabric and people's obligations of loyalty and of belonging and of social cohesion. The most outrageous example of this media propaganda was the malicious campaign, the propaganda came against the target of Queen Mary Antoinette. Although the princess was initially very popular, she was a very beautiful princess from Austria, there were elder members of the court who deeply resented having an Austrian as heir to the throne and made her the target of outrageous smears, gossip, and slander. To this day, you would hear some of the lies about Mary Antoinette. They said that she said, if they have no bread, then let them eat cake. Which she never said. It's not possible. It's absolute nonsense. She ran soup kitchens. She adopted and cared for the poor. She was very generous and very much concerned for the poorest members of society. And yet they invented lies and they fabricated scandals in order to get the most intelligent person in the government sidelined. She was generous with her friends and with the poor alike. The princess became a major patron of the arts. She sponsored soup kitchens for the poor. She innovated education for orphans. She adopted some of the unfortunates. But despite this, her enemies circulated rumors, which over 200 years later, some people still believe, that she was extravagant and immoral and plastered the walls with gold and diamonds. But the real reasons for France's financial woes were not Marie Antoinette's shopping, which was mostly invented, but the enormous war debts incurred by France during the Seven Years' War, and later the expense of assisting the North American colonies in their war against France's traditional rival and enemy, Great Britain. So France was putting the money into foreign wars, and that's why the people were bankrupt, but they decided to blame Marie Antoinette instead of their own government's policies. Despite her enemies depicting as frivolous and heartless, she had many meaningful friendships. She was an avid reader of historical novels. She studied English. She certainly never said the quote attributed to her. Most people only know this about Marie Antoinette, and it's a lie, that she is meant to have said, if they have no bread, then let them eat cake, which is a very clever little propaganda quote, but it's a total and complete lie. All historians dismiss as revolutionary propaganda that quote which is attributed to Marie Antoinette. It was because she was Austrian by nationality that she was a convenient target for the revolutionaries, because they hated Austria. The French involvement in the American War of Independence against Great Britain had created an enormous war debt for France. And this debt added to the financial crisis which had started with France's involvement in the earlier ruinous Seven Years' War against Great Britain and Germany, or as Germany was known then, Prussia. This colossal debt added to the financial crises which propelled the French state into bankruptcy. King Louis XVI, who gets a bad press because of propaganda, actually began his reign very wisely. He dismissed the large number of corrupt and incompetent ministers that he inherited from the court of his father, Louis XV. He appointed an excellent economist, Anne Robert Jean Turgot, as the control general, which would be like the Minister of the Treasury or Minister of Finance. And Turgot proposed drastic solutions to France's crisis, cancelling all tax privileges for the nobles, abolishing industrial monopolies, removing restrictions on free enterprise. Other bold, practical, wise solutions. However, the nobles then pressured Louis XVI to dismiss this very excellent economist Turgot. The young banker Jacques Necker was then given the task of managing the unmanageable bankrupt economy. He bravely tried some short-term measures to stave off the inevitable economic collapse. But when he attempted to move towards adopting Turgot's free market strategies, the privileged nobles and the wealthy middle classes forced the king to dismiss him too. So two excellent economists dismissed, and all that's happening is they're going down the drain financially. This was in 1781. Louis entrusted one hapless, unfortunate man after another with a financial crisis, but all to no avail, because they weren't allowed to do what was essential to save the economy. France's international credit rating was plummeting. The country was no longer able to secure loans. Now remember, this may be hard for you to imagine from this perspective, but the superpower of the world in the 1700s was France. It wasn't Britain. It wasn't America or Russia. They hadn't risen up yet. Germany was not yet a great superpower. France was the superpower before the French Revolution. France was the greatest and most influential nation on earth. It had the greatest army, it had the greatest wealth, it had the greatest economy. France was the center of civilization in many people's minds. But the French Revolution destroyed that. By mid-1788, the government had become paralyzed and was no longer able to avoid admitting they were actually bankrupt. The king was forced to reinstate Necker and call for a meeting of the States General on May 1789. That is the date, that is the year when the French Revolution is normally marked from. This is what had led up to the French Revolution. Financial irresponsibility and economic bankruptcy. The States General consisted of three houses. The first estate was the clergy, the ministers, bishops. The second estate were the nobles, the barons and marquises. Third estate were the merchants and the common people. Although the third house had twice as many people as the other houses, each house was historically understood to have only one vote. So you had basically three houses. Louis's government failed to specify how the three houses of the States General were to function, nor did he provide them with an agenda or a constitution, which was actually quite foolish and dangerous, because that meant that they could do almost anything. There should have been some written direction and some basic laws which they should be sworn to uphold. The commoners in the third house now boldly organized themselves into a self-contained national assembly, inspired by the writings of Voltaire and Rousseau. So the commoners now organized themselves as a national assembly. And the nobles were outraged and convinced Louis XVI to send troops to blockade the hall where the assembly planned to meet. Because what they were doing was actually revolutionary. The third estate then met on a nearby tennis court and vowed to continue in session until they could complete a new constitution for the nation. This is the famous tennis court oath that basically led to the revolution. This was outright rebellion against the authority of the king. Now, France is meant to be a monarchy at this stage. Yet on the 27th of June 1789, Louis ordered the other two estates to join the commoners in this new combined assembly. In this way, he fueled and enabled the revolution that was going to cost him his head, and worse, for the rest of his country. The National Assembly spent most of its time debating the latest philosophical and political theories, which was following basically the revolutionary ideas of Rousseau and Voltaire. Now, the Marquis de Lafayette, who had achieved fame through his involvement in the American War of Independence, because he had been sent by the French to go and help the Americans to fight the British, he espoused the cause of freedom and rallied the liberal wing of the nobles around him. But there was a great misunderstanding. The French did not understand that the American War of Independence was not a revolution, really. It was a war of independence. And they were thinking of America's a great example of freedom, and we need to do that in France. But what they missed was the American War of Independence was fought by Christians who held to a Protestant worldview, who had a biblical worldview, who believed in laws, who were... The Americans never lynched people, guillotined people, beheaded people. They didn't steal people's property and have mob violence in the streets. It was a very Christian war of independence. It wasn't run by secular humanists who had no standards. And that's the difference. They tried to implement in France what had succeeded in America, but forgetting the Christian base. America had a Christian foundation, a Protestant biblical foundation. France did not. France was meant to be Roman Catholic, but in fact was already very humanist, and they had lost the fear of God, and they had lost to understand the Bible. And so the French society was rotten at the core. What worked in America was not going to work in France. But the Marquis de Lafayette did not see that. He thought that he could replicate in France what he had seen in America. The Count of Mirabeau dominated the assembly through his eloquent campaign for a constitutional monarchy. But the most fanatical extremist gravitated to Maximilien Robespierre, a name you should remember. Robespierre was the original Karl Marx, if you can put it that way. Karl Marx's inspiration comes more from Robespierre, Rousseau, and Voltaire. In fact, Vladimir Lenin would be the 20th century version of Maximilien Robespierre. He was a strong devotee of the writings of the radicals Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire. Rousseau wrote, "It is necessary to have a cohesive force to organize and coordinate the movements of society's members." In other words, you might talk about freedom, but what you mean is you've got a cohesive force that's organizing and manipulating the people. whether it's the party, or whether it's the Commissar, or the KGB, the point is, they believe that people can't be allowed to choose for themselves. You've got to tell them what to choose and force them. Rousseau advocated constant agitation for equality in order to maintain an atmosphere of fear where individual differences are no longer tolerated. Do away with the family, was what he said. And Rousseau was such a lowlife, he produced many, many, many children who he abandoned to the poorhouses and most of them died of starvation before they were age 5 because he believed it was wrong to have a family, and so he never cared for his own offspring. His own children, he just abandoned them all. I don't know if any survived. He might have produced something like 26 different orphan children, none of whom he was willing to raise. He just threw them into the orphanage where they died of neglect. Do away with the family was his whole philosophy. Inspired by the defiance of the assembly and stirred up by the revolutionary pamphlets and speeches, mobs began to roam the streets of Paris, attacking and murdering royal officials. France's financial house of cards collapsed. Everything was built on debts and more debts, and it just collapsed. Capital fled the country. Suddenly all the money was out. Economic depression resulted. A series of events combined to create food shortages and hunger. And that was deliberate, because to make the people more agitated and more willing to risk their lives and to fight and kill on the streets, they had to be starving. And so that was deliberately created to make sure there was shortage of food. Agitators panned out across the countryside to destroy the grain stores and to terrorize the inhabitants. They weren't on the side of the people, or they wouldn't have destroyed the food that the people needed. But they destroyed the grain stores. They created conditions that were conducive to revolution. Hired mobs staged spontaneous riots in Paris. They were actually paid to riot. The powers of government then collapsed. Everything fell apart with astonishing coordination. It looked like it was spontaneous, but it had been planned, and it was organized, it was orchestrated, and the media was in on it, and the revolutionaries had a plan. In reaction, some of the nobles persuaded the king to try to reassert his royal authority. Soldiers were ordered onto the streets of Paris in a show of strength. And the appearance of the soldiers inspired the mobs to seize whatever weapons they could find and to storm the old fortress of the Bastille. The French Revolution is officially dated from this point, the 14th of July, 1789, the date they stormed the Bastille. The Bastille had become a symbol of hated tyranny. Much legend has grown out of this event, but the reality is far less inspiring. As it so happens, there were no political prisoners at the Bastille at that time. They make it out they were storming the Bastille to release political prisoners. Well, there were none. Despite the fact that the lieutenant governor of the Bastille, M. de Launay, was guaranteed safe conduct and surrendered the fortress under a white flag of truce, yet the mob massacred the soldiers and the governor and cut off their heads and carried them on spikes throughout the streets. This is the kind of behavior of revolutionaries. The body parts of the defenders of the Bastille were paraded through the streets, and a mere 7 prisoners, all common criminals, were found in the Bastille. No political prisoners at all. When the news reached the palace of Versailles, King Louis was astonished. "This is revolt," he said. And his advisor, the Duc de la Rochefort-Liancourt, responded, "No, sire, it is a revolution." The next day, King Louis arrived simply dressed with no bodyguards, with no attendants, and he spoke at the National Assembly, which was actually an act of great courage. He ordered his troops to leave Paris so that the people would have no reason to fear the king, to show he's not against the people. Louis assured them he had confidence in assembly, and deputies rose to their feet, cheering with great fervor. 88 of the deputies gathered at the Paris City Hall and took turns speaking to an enormous crowd from the balcony. And the famous 32-year-old Lafayette was elected General of the National Guard, which is to replace the present army. And while many seemed optimistic for the future, Marie Antoinette, who is definitely the most intelligent person in the royal palace, was filled with foreboding, and she burned her private papers knowing, "We've got to get ready to flee." Nobles started to flee the court and flee the country, and many settled across the border they could see the writing on the wall that they were in peril of their lives. On the 17th of July, the king travelled to Paris to identify with the revolutionary mob. It's only a few days after the 14th of July that they'd stormed Bastille. So this is very brave. This king is many things, but he's not a coward. In October, a mob marched to Versailles demanding that the king transfer his inheritance, his residence, to Paris. Versailles outside of Paris, they want to move into Paris where he could be more controlled. Otto Scott observed Paris, like the nation, was divided into the politically active and the passive. Between the many confused, disorganized and abstracted, and the highly concentrated, organized and intent few. Always, every revolution is run by a small minority. They claim to do it in the names of the people, but in fact, they're manipulating the people, and the people are just cannon fodder. Two clubs came to dominate the assembly at this time. We might call them parties today. There were the Cordeliers, led by Jacques Danton, and then there was Jean-Paul Marat. So Danton and Marat, two of the most vile Marxist revolutionaries in Paris. But the most radical of all, the Jacobins, were skillfully manipulated by Robespierre. Danton and Marat were bad, but Robespierre was even more evil. It was in the French Revolution that the term left-wing and right-wing was first coined. You've heard them speaking about left-wing and right-wing, first used in the French Revolution. Those on the left were the radicals, who proudly adopted the term left as a symbol of their revolutionary defiance of Christian tradition. Because in the Bible, those on the right hand of God, the Lord said to those on his right, "Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." And he said to those on his left, "Depart from me, cursed, into the lake of fire prepared for the devil and his angels." The Bible says that the heart of the fool is on his left side. The Bible continually speaks about left as bad and negative and right as intelligent, taking the right path. And so, in Fire in the Minds of Men, Origin of Revolutionary Faith, James Billington points out that the revolutionary specifically, intentionally, consciously adopted the term left and left wing to indicate then rebellion to God. On the 4th of August 1789, the nobles and the clergy renounced their privileges in the name of revolutionary equality. On the 2nd of November, the assembly voted to issue new paper money called assignats, which sparked off rampant inflation, something like what Mugabe's Zimbabwe dollars managed to do. Worthless piece of paper. On the 2nd of November, the assembly voted to confiscate all church property. On July 1790, the assembly nationalized the Roman Catholic Church by enacting the civil constitution of the clergy. You see here depicted, which actually happened, churches being burned and priests being hung in public while others are guillotined and nuns being hung. And this is what the French Revolution was. It was an anti-Christian, violent Marxist revolution. The assembly undertook to pay the salaries of the priests from the national treasury and to create a French church under the control of the government. This is Marxism. This is communism, where the state takes control of the church. Pope Pius VI excommunicated all clergymen who took the new oath, which was demanded by the assembly, because how can a minister be a minister if he has taken an oath of allegiance to a revolutionary government, or any government for that matter? Most of the clergy refused, of course, to take this oath, and they were evicted from the pulpits and parishes, and many were executed. France was divided into 83 departments or counties. And the National Assembly produced the Declaration of the Rights of Men and Citizens. And look at its shape. What does this remind you of? The Ten Commandments, the law of Moses. They're creating a new law. Declaration of the Rights of Man. But it does not acknowledge Almighty God. It does not acknowledge the Creator. And so, although this was patented in some ways after the English Bill of Rights of 1689 and the American Bill of Rights, which had been appended to the American Constitution, the French Declaration of Rights embodied mostly humanist ideals of the Enlightenment. It was not based on Christian ideals, although they did borrow some Christian concepts for their Declaration of Human Rights. It's not all bad. but it was terrible in its results. While attempting to adopt many of the forms of the biblically oriented Magna Carta, or the Great Charter of 1215, this year we celebrate 800 years of the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta, or the Great Charter in England, was authored by clergyman Stephen Langton, and the Magna Carta is the grandfather of all Bills of Rights. All Bills of Rights owe their beginnings to the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta and the later English Bill of Rights are thoroughly biblical, but the French Declaration of the Rights of Man failed to recognize the Creator, and it ignored the biblical foundations for true freedom. So to speak about freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of movement and freedom of all this, that sounds great, but without a biblical base, it doesn't work out that way. They claimed to give freedom of religion in Red China and the Soviet Union, but they killed millions of people and destroyed 50,000 churches in Russia alone, all in the name of religious freedom. You see, if you don't have a biblical base, you don't even know what right and wrong is. It just is what I think and what I feel and what the Commissar says. A new constitution was completed in 1791. With a unicameral legislature, that means one chamber, no longer three chambers, one chamber, elected by what they called active citizens. That doesn't mean everyone got a vote, it meant those who supported the revolution got the vote, which is not democracy at all. Before Mirabeau died in April 1791, he predicted that all their well-deliberated efforts at reform would collapse and would be washed away in a bloodbath, which in fact it was. Louis XVI now attempted to flee with his family from France on the night of the 20th of June 1791. The revolution has been on the go for 2 years, and he finally realizes there is no hope. This is only going in an ugly downward direction. To save his family, he tries to flee the country. But when the radicals discovered them, they blocked their path and escorted the royal family back to Paris in great procession, with the revolutionary forces around them. Danton and Robespierre seized upon this event as an opportunity to proclaim that France now is a republic, meaning no king. As the new legislative assembly met on the 1st of October, 1791, the Girondists proposed replacing the just adopted constitution and creating a republic. Deeply concerned for the fate of the royal family, Austria, ruled by Leopold II, the brother of Marie Antoinette, prepared to invade France because the life of his sister and his nephews and nieces are at stake. The assembly now declared war on Austria in 1792, and the French were soon defeated by the Austrians and Prussians because revolutionary fervor does not equal military competence, and they were sadly ill-prepared, and they were outmaneuvered by the well-disciplined Austrians and Germans. The mob then stormed the king's residence and massacred the Royal Swiss Guard, who were the bodyguards of the king and the queen. And the Swiss Guards died to the last man. Not one surrendered. It is an ugly, horrible, vile massacre with hideous, grotesque mutilations of the dead bodies. The assembly now voted to depose the king and write a new constitution that toppled the statues to the king and previous kings. On the 10th of August 1792, the municipal government was overthrown and Danton became the self-appointed national dictator. In the name of freedom, they now had a dictator. The entire male population were drafted for military service. Weapons production entered high gear. September 1792, terrorist mobs swarmed through the prisons and massacred thousands of prisoners, including many nobles and their wives and daughters and children, for no other reason than they were nobility. Anyone who's intelligent, well-educated, wealthy, well-off, whatever, they were all killed. And you can only imagine the brutality of these satanically motivated, demon-possessed mobs screaming through the streets and killing defenseless civilians and massacring people in prison cells with nowhere they could even flee. A new national convention was called on the 21st of September 1792 to write a new constitution. In December 1792, the convention summoned the deposed king, who they now called Louis Coppet, And on the 21st of January 1793, the king, King Louis XVI, was beheaded on the guillotine. Now, people today have made out that Louis XVI was an oppressive king, and that's why he is overthrown and decapitated. Actually, he was a reforming king who gave the people more freedoms than they'd had in a previous century. He opened the States General, which had been closed for about 80 years, for generations. He gave huge amounts of freedoms to the people. And so he was executed not because he was repressive, but because he was reforming. Because he was open to the needs of the people, he ended up as a victim of them. All of Europe was horrified, and a coalition was formed against France for this grotesque crime. Austria, England, Holland, Prussia, Spain, Piedmont, all prepared to restore order to France. The Jacobins mobilized the mob to invade the convention and arrest the leading 31 Girondists. This launched the Reign of Terror, which officially began the 2nd of June, 1793. Robespierre established what he called the Committee of Public Safety. Notice they always have these totally dishonest names. Committee of Public Safety. It's actually a committee of terrorism is more like it. A policy of mass public terror was unleashed with revolutionary tribunals in which all the enemies of the revolution were summarily tried. A mere accusation was tantamount to a verdict of guilt. Trials were abrupt with no real opportunity granted to the accused to prepare or present any defense. Drunken fools were lying around in the courts getting completely drunk. In would be brought on. What's the verdict? Guilty! Penalty? Death! First went out, no chance to defend themselves, no facts, no evidence, no rules of evidence, just what you call a summary tribunal. The accused were quickly converted and carted off to the guillotine, where their heads were chopped off. This is the Reign of Terror. The Queen, only 38 years old at this stage, Marie Antoinette, was dragged through the mockery of a trial on 16 October 1793 and guillotined the very next day. Not even given the opportunity of having a priest to have confession with or to pray with, she was separated from her children, brutally treated, but courageous. She was tried by this revolutionary tribunal and remained composed in the face of outrageous accusations and abuse. Marie Antoinette was very courageous. She declared that she had a clear conscience. She professed her Christian faith and her love for her children. And her children had been taken away and treated horribly. Within a day, her hair was cut short and she was driven through Paris in an open cart wearing a simple white dress. Why did they even need to cut her hair short? There was no respect for anyone. At 12:15, at the age of 37, she's executed at the Place de la Révolution, today called the Place de la Concorde. She was courageous to the very last, one of the most courageous queens in history. Her son, later recognized as Louis XVII, died as a result of inhumane treatment by his revolutionary jailers. The jailers separated him from her mother, and they brought him to the point where he would reject the Christian faith and curse Christ. Then they let him die. They wanted to be sure that he didn't go to heaven like his parents. They wanted to destroy him spiritually and morally before they let him die of just neglect and abuse. That's the kind of people that ran the French Revolution. Vindictive to the core. In 1815, after the Battle of Waterloo and the defeat of the French Revolutionary forces, the Restoration restored both the body of Louis XVI and of Marie Antoinette, and they received a decent Christian burial in the necropolis of the French royalty, the Basilica de Saint-Denis. Few women have had to endure such a total reversal of fortunes, being born at the very apex of power and privilege in Europe, of the greatest empire in the world at that time, Austria and then France, and dying at the hands of a brutal, cruel, demonic mob during the French Revolution. Marie Antoinette was a victim of circumstances completely outside of her control. yet she faced her fate with Christian courage and with faith. 21 Girondist leaders, who also revolutionaries, including Madame Roland, was also beheaded shortly after the Queen. This is what revolutions do. They become cannibalistic. They start to kill their own. 21 Girondists. These were some of the leaders of the revolution. They were ones who had voted for the death of the King and the Queen. They ended up in the same guillotine. The Duke of Orleans, who had joined the Jacobins and taken the name of Citizen Egalitaire, even voting for the death of his cousin, the King. He was also executed at this time. He thought he could save his life by betraying his own family. Romantic occultism taught a Big Bang theory of social science. If you can blow up enough things or burn down enough buildings and kill enough people, you can produce utopia. You see, what do the evolutionaries believe? The Big Bang. There was once nothing and then boom, big explosion and everything came about. Trees and dinosaurs and mountains and forests and rivers and people and whales, dolphins. So, if you can have a big enough explosion or enough burnings, then we can have paradise, right? And that's the idea. If it makes sense in science, then it can make sense in social science. That destruction will bring about something good. Lenin said, never underestimate the value of constructive chaos. Constructive chaos. I think you see those people in the world today. Those people who think if you can burn down enough things, kill enough people, bomb enough things, then paradise will result. That's as likely as a bomb in a printing press producing an encyclopedia or Bible. The reign of terror spread throughout France, and when one city sought to resist, it was destroyed. The revolutionaries set up a pillar outside Lyon, inscribed, Lyon waged war with liberty and Lyon is no more. Of course, it didn't wage war with liberty, it waged war with tyranny. But remember, revolutionaries call good evil and evil good, sweet bitter and bitter sweet, light darkness, darkness light. They call themselves liberty, committed public safety, but in fact they're the opposite. They speak about freedom, but they themselves are slaves of corruption. Toulon was subjugated under the leadership of a young artillery officer from Corsica called Napoleon Bonaparte. The Committee of Public Safety launched a vicious atheistic war against Christianity. They invented a new religion that they called the Cult of Reason, where they literally set up idols that people bowed before and burned incense in front of. At a festival at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, an actress was enthroned as the goddess of the French people. France was renamed the Republic of Virtue. Place of whoremongering, massacres, orgies and perversion, and they call it the Republic of Virtue. This is a massacre of language and meaning. Ancient Rome was lifted up as its model. Why? Because Rome was not Christian. Rome killed Christians. Rome crucified Christ. Therefore, they loved Rome. And Rome became their model, because it was anti-Christian, pre-Christian. And therefore they had Caesars and they had empires and invading other countries. The press and the theatres were turned into instruments for straight propaganda. They couldn't waste entertainment, it had to be used for propaganda. Fashions changed to immoral loose Roman robes. Over 2,000 churches were renamed temples of reason and hijacked for the promotion of this cult. It just took over churches and used them for secular humanism and atheism. They even adopted their own versions of marriage. Historian Arnold Toynbee says, in the revolution, a sinister ancient religion suddenly re-erupted with elemental violence, primitive violence. The fanatical worship of collective human power. The terror was only the first of the mass crimes that have been committed in the evil religion's name. And this is a fact. This is what the French Revolution was. It was the first of the mass crimes that have been committed in the name of secular humanism or atheism. The revolutionaries now began to turn on one another. Danton was executed the 5th of April, 1794. On the 7th of May, Robespierre sought to impose a new religion on France, declaring a new calendar to replace the Christian calendar, a 10-day work week, and making the day that they ended the monarchy, the 21st of September 1792, the first day of year one of the revolutionary calendar. So they started to start a new calendar. Now, of course, it's failed. Robespierre appointed himself the high priest of the supreme being in this new cult. On the 27th of July 1794, Robespierre and 20 of his henchmen were seized and executed by the survivors of the convention. He who had executed 40,000 people in the guillotine ended up in the same guillotine. This is justice. What a man sows, that shall he reap. More than 40,000 people, most of them very innocent, had been murdered on the guillotine during the Reign of Terror. 300,000 others murdered by firing squads or by drownings. Over two-thirds of these victims had been peasants, poor people, artisans, workers. They weren't all nobles. In fact, only about a third were. As Madame Roland had been ushered up to the platform to be guillotined, she faced the statue of the goddess Liberty and cried out, "Oh, Liberty, Liberty, what crimes are committed in thy name?" Well, she had chaired the guillotining of many, many people before, and she ended up in the same guillotine. What you sow is what you reap. The end of the Reign of Terror was not the end of the French Revolution, unfortunately. It was followed by the Directory and by the dictatorship of Napoleon, which eventually culminated in Napoleon's empire, which embroiled all of Europe in a ruinous 25-year war. Even after the death of Robespierre, the revolution continued to talk about liberty and equality. But they were actually just fighting the Christian faith and inspiring more communes and Voice of Virtue and Vladimir Lenin's and Mao Tse-tung's and Joseph Stalin's and Fidel Castro's. The French Revolution was the prototype, which was followed by the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, the Cambodian Revolution, the Vietnamese Revolution, the Ethiopian Revolution, the Mozambican Revolution, the Angolan Revolution, the Zimbabwean Revolution, and many others. In every case, they proved that yesterday's revolutionaries become tomorrow's tyrants and dictators. As in Samora Machel Avenue in Harare, a boot on the neck of Christians, with the police holding Kalashnikov assault rifles and helmets and battle gear, whipping people on the streets, beating women outside the courts as they call for justice. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 is true for the French Revolution, and it's true for every revolution. In fact, I will state and challenge anyone to think of an example that could prove me wrong, that every revolution has produced a worse situation than what they claimed they were liberating people from. Every revolution fails because every revolution is antichrist, humanistic, unbiblical. Revolutionaries become tyrants. Revolutions put the people under worse suffering than they ever were before. And that is why we as Christians cannot be revolutionaries. We must be reformers. We are for revival. We are for the fulfillment of the Great Commission. We are for regeneration, first and foremost, because evil is in the hearts of men. And a revolution only replaces one group of sinners with often a worse group of sinners. What one needs is not revolution, but regeneration, reformation, and revival. This lecture is available. We've got it also on the data discs. There's an excellent book that you can read if you want to understand the French Revolution, Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities. In fact, when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister of Britain, she gave as a gift to the French President, François Mitterrand, a leather-bound copy of this very book, Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities. And I think it's brilliant because The Tale of Two Cities shows the difference between London and Paris. London was gripped by revival. In the next session after tea, we're going to be looking at John and Charles Wesley and the great revival, the great evangelical awakening in England. You see, London was Christian. Paris was humanist. London was going through revival. Paris was going through revolution. In London, people were being saved. In Paris, they were being beheaded. And so this Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens is an excellent commentary and contrast on the difference. We are either going to have revival or we are going to have revolution. Either the church gets revived and serious about fulfilling the Great Commission, or the world will fulfill its goals in revolution. life or death. That is the choice. And so for the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher to have given this book to the French president is most appropriate, because there is no example in history more clear as the contrast between God's way and man's way than the French Revolution and the great evangelical awakening in England. A Tale of Two Cities. And so this has been made into different films. I think the best one is the Ronald Coleman version, 1930s. There have been others since, but they have far less Christian input. This older 1930s version on the French Revolution ends with scripture. Powerful. Powerful Christian film. Back in the days when they actually made films true to the book and with the scriptures in it. But a lot of the modern ones are not anywhere near as good. There's a book you should have in your library, the very, very best book in the French Revolution, the one that has provided most of the material that I've given in this lecture, Robespierre, The Fool is Revolutionary Inside the French Revolution by Otto Scott. Otto Scott's one of the finest historians of the 20th century, and his book, Robespierre, is the best expose of the French Revolution I've ever read. So, any questions, any comments at all? Yeah, it's a process. So what happened was, from 1789, the French Revolution began. From 1792, the Reign of Terror began. Now, there had been terror before, but the Reign of Terror, capital R, capital T, began. And that was when Robespierre became the dictator, and he started to wipe out the people in great numbers. The French Revolution continued through the Directory of Three leaders, of which Napoleon was one. And officially, you say the French Revolution ended when Napoleon became emperor in 1799. So 1789 to 1799 is officially the French Revolution. They've gone from monarchy to republic, but now to dictatorship, to now in 1799 they become an empire. And now they've gone from a monarchy through revolution and republic and dictatorship to an emperor. This is the prototype. This is what happens. Just like what you've seen. Whether you talk about Mugabe or Mao Zedong or Stalin, Lenin, they start out as liberators and end up as tyrants, worse than anything they'd ever tried to overthrow. This is human nature. It is the depravity of man in action. Great ideals, shocking results. Saviors of men become the worst oppressors in the end. And in the French Revolution, then we can say the French Revolution ended when Napoleon became emperor. But he was also a product of the revolution. And he claimed that he is spreading the French revolutionary ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity by invading all the rest of Europe, which ended in the Battle of Waterloo, of course, in 1815. This year we celebrate 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, this coming June, because it is 200 years since the defeat of the French Revolutionary Forces, Battle of Waterloo, which ended their goals of world domination, to send revolution to the whole world. So, while we recognize that the revolution proper ended in 1799, 10 years after the French Revolution began, but the wars continued for another 15 years. And so, we call it the second phase of the revolution, when it became the empire of Napoleon. Historians will argue as to, do you speak about the French Revolution just in the first 10 years or in the whole 25 years? I think it's correct to speak of the French Revolution all the way up to Waterloo, 25 years, but correctly speaking, it's two distinct phases. And you can see when Napoleon became emperor, it was a very different... for example, Napoleon would not tolerate mobs in the street. He just turned cannons on him. He said, you can't reason with a mob. So he literally turned cannons on and fire into mobs. He did that. Because he said, you cannot trust the mob. The mob put him in power, but once he's in power, he turned the cannons on the mob. So once the Republic became an empire, I think we're talking about something else. So I've only taken us up to the end of the Reign of Terror. But this, I think you can see, is explosive, because the French Revolution is the prototype revolution. People like Marx, Lenin, Mugabe, Mao Zedong, all of them would look back to the French Revolution as the Golden Age. They look back to the French Revolution like we look back to the Reformation. You know, to us, the Reformation is an inspiring high point in church history. to most revolutionaries and humanists, though, the French Revolution is a wonderful thing. Oh, if we could just get back to the French revolutionary principles. And to them, it is like the gospel. Other questions?